everybody, and welcome to another installment of Innovation Crush. It's me, Chris Denson, talking to you again, blabbing at you. In case you're just tuning in for the first time, this show covers all things marketing, innovation, ideas, creative business strategies, et cetera, and we try to have fun while we talk about it. And today, I have Pop-Tart Impresario, and Kingpin. No, just kidding. Steve Street. Say hello, Steve.
Chris, how are you? And it is true that I'm intermittently eating a brown sugar frosted Pop-Tart as we speak.
Oh, details. Brown sugar. I like you already. You're already detailed. This is going to be a great interview. Why are you eating a Pop-Tart on the show? This is the first, by the way.
I was hungry, and it was the fastest thing I could think to put in the toaster, albeit I try to be healthier. But
there's bagels, and I mean, there's all kinds of stuff you could have. That's fine. I like Pop-Tarts myself. So I wanted to at least start with a little bit of 101, right? Steve Street. Earlier I was singing Easy Street from Annie, the original one, but I don't know if you go by that name, but would love to just get a sort of a 101 on you and Green Dot Corporation and the multiple things that are in the proverbial envelope there.
You bet. What's the best place to start? Do you want to hear about a Green Dot Corporation and how that got started,
let's kind of back up. Let's start with Green Dot. That would be awesome. Just to get people up to speed with where you are. I mean, it's an amazing story, an amazing product. So, we can start there and then kind of back up to the history of Street.
Yeah. Okay. Well, today Green Dot is a bank holding company, based in Los Angeles, California. And our main product that we invented many years ago is the prepaid debit card that you see sold at retail stores all across the country. So if you go into any CVS, Rite Aid, Walgreens, 7-Eleven, Walmart, so forth and so on, you'll see a Green Dot rack that has a collection of MasterCard and Visa products that are prepaid debit cards. They're just like a bank account. They are a bank account. And consumers can use those to to control their money and be part of the banking system in the same way that you may have a checking account or savings account. So that's what the product is, and that's what we are today. And it's become a good-sized company, but maybe through this interview I'll share with you the rest of the story.
Oh, that'd be great.
And you'll have the background.
I guess, define invented. Right. You know, I think we hear that term a lot, especially in these kinds of interviews where, when you talk about the prepaid card industry, right? Can we get the beginning of the invention of what is now known as prepaid?
Well, so rewind to the dark years of 1999 when the internet was called online and when the way you accessed that internet was through a dial-up connection from typically it was America Online or Prodigy would have been two big ones. And I'm sure there were others that I remember. But, that's the world we lived in, and you would boot up on your modem, and you would go get a cup of coffee, take a shower, and by the time you got back, if you were lucky, you were online. And that's where we were. Broadband, or what became known as high speed, was not really known except to certain college campuses in a trial format. But everyone knew that over time, broadband and high speed would be in every neighborhood and then in every home and apartment building. And when that happened, the internet would one day become something big with bigger files that you could exchange and all the things that, in fact, has happened. And it's happened in even a bigger way than I think anyone even predicted back then.
Yeah.
But back then, it was all a dial-up world. And I was I was in the radio business. So I was in the radio business for almost 20 years as a disc jockey early in my life, very early, like college aged and that kind of thing. But I was not very good at it, but I did it. And although my only claim to fame, Chris, as a disc jockey is I was the fill-in host for American Top 40 with the legendary Casey Kasem.
Oh, wow.
And I worked for Casey for a short period of time. I did about 8 shows, and then he called me up and fired me because he said I was not natural in the way I read the long-distance dedications.
Man, I should have sent you a dedication just so you could read it on this show, and we could either prove him wrong or nod in agreement.
Well, if Mr. Kasem were alive today, he'd be jealous that I was on your show, and he would have known that he made the wrong choice.
Well, yes. Well, if he had not said that, you probably would not have taken this path, right? I mean, it's, well, you got
pointed. He was sort of a side job. I was at that point a manager in radio, but enjoy the creative aspects of radio in those days. I came up with a lot of different formats, or I took other people's formats and executed them differently, and had a very successful career in formats that were targeted towards families and women in particular. And the format is called Adult Contemporary. It's still around today. Every market in America has a leading adult contemporary radio station. In Los Angeles, it would be KBIG or Coast FM, and those stations are all still there. And those are the types of radio stations that I have programmed and managed around the country.
And that's not to be confused with adult websites, correct?
What's that? No, yeah, adult contemporary would be moms and minivans.
Okay,
and that
great.
Kind of thing.
All right.
Yeah.
It's a whole lot.
Think Celine Dion and, you know, that kind of music.
Yeah.
So, okay. So I was doing that and was leaving radio after 20 years. And as one of the little goodbye parties that I had or lunches that I had, I was invited out to lunch with a guy who was a record rep at Disney Records, or I think back then it was called Hollywood Records, over there in Burbank. And I had lunch there with him, and he told me about this new website they had called Go.com, which was the Disney ABC website, and that, you know, it was going okay, but that really only kids ever came to the site, and they never bought anything, and so he wasn't quite sure whether or not it would work out. And I said, why don't kids buy anything? And he said, well, because kids don't have credit cards. Adults do, and most parents don't want their kids to buy stuff online with their cards. So that was really the beginning of the idea. And I came home, and I was driving home, and I thought of something called a million-dollar idea. And I wrote it down on a piece of paper, and I went to my neighbor's house, a fellow named Chuck Murray, who lived next door to me in San Marino, California. And I said, hey, Chuck, I have this idea for a credit card for kids. And, you know, he said that was interesting, but that was about that. And over some months to come, I refined that idea and realized it can't be a credit card. It had to be a debit card. But you had to be a certain age for a debit card. And you start learning all the technology and all the rules. And that's what the invention or the thought was. But the product didn't exist. There was a product that was similar that was sold by some banks called Visa Bucks. And these were all called host-based stored value cards. And as the process went further, it occurred to me that nobody knew what that was, and it wasn't a great marketing handle. But whenever I explained my idea to investors or to a family member, they would say, well, I don't know what you're talking about. Do you mean like a prepaid telephone card, like a calling card? And I'd say, yeah, just like that. When you use the minutes, you're up, and here when you use your money, you're done. And I said, prepaid. I'll call it a prepaid card. And that's how I came up with the phrase prepaid.
This is amazing.
And with that, we launched with the iGen MasterCard, which stood for Internet Generation. It launched at 98 Rite Aid stores in the Washington, D.C. metro. It sold okay. But kids were not buying it to buy stuff online. It was adults who were buying it to pay bills and to do various things. And so we talked to some of the customers and said, hey, how come you're buying this card? It was meant for kids. And why did you buy it? Well, we bought it because we have bad credit and can't get a checking account. We can't get a credit card. But, you know, we want to have a MasterCard. And I thought, aha, I've got the right product but the wrong target audience. So
right. We
pulled off the packaging off the shelf at Rite Aid and replaced it with packaging that was targeted for an adult audience instead of kids. And the product took off. And after Rite Aid came CVS, and after CVS came other retailers. And one by one, we built up to where we are today. And today we're in 100,000 retailers. And we also have a checking account product that's at retail and also online and in the app stores called GoBank. And it's become a big public company. But that's how we started.
Now, you know, you hear a lot of entrepreneurs go, oh, and I had that one idea, and then, I decided to do it. Like, why was this the idea you decided to go after, right? Because I would imagine after especially years in radio and, you know, the number of guests and just the creative juices that kind of flow in a creative production environment, you're just constantly thinking of ideas anyway. But why was this the one you decided to kind of put your heart and energy into? Why was this the thing for Steve?
Well, I think it was something, which is why you know, after I left radio and went into this full time, I was lucky enough to have had some Clear Channel stock. And when Clear Channel bought the company I was with a company called AMFM. And when the company was purchased by Clear Channel, my stock turned into Clear Channel stock. And so I had some money left over. And by the time I came up with this idea, I'd blown through a lot of it because I wasn't working and I was living off of savings. And so I think by the time this one came around, I realized that I had no choice but to make it successful. And I also had a friend from radio who we're still best friends. His name is Benson Reisman, who was my co-founder. Benson worked for CBS Radio, but did the same type of thing I did. And he said, hey, I'll do sales if you do everything else and you fund it. You be the money guy and the manager, if you will, the CEO, and I'll be the sales guy. And that's what we did. And Benson encouraged me a lot, too. He said, hey, I think you have something big here. You know, you should really focus on this. And I think it was a combination of desperation, knowing that I really couldn't change course and I had to be committed. And we did think it was a pretty cool idea, and we were getting traction in our sales meetings with retailers. And so we kept at it. But it's not obvious. The idea is not obvious in retrospect, and the product success has not been obvious. And it's been a wonderful journey. I mean, there's been so many near-death experiences over those 15 years that the company's been around, but that's part of the journey. And it worked out okay. But that's why that idea made it. I think it was in the absence of any better ideas, it seemed like the right idea.
Well, it's kind of like stay the course, right? Like, you know, especially if you've got, like, you know, you're halfway there, right? You look back and it's too far to go back, and you look ahead and it's almost too far to see, but you're like, stay the course. And what was that piece of it like? Because I'm sure there was a transition part. Like you said, you were kind of running out of your own personal money. Like, you may have needed your own prepaid card at that point in time. Right. but, you know, what were you going through at that point where you go, like, you know, you're kind of in the middle of the sea of decision?
Well, it wasn't a great time, you know, and I was 30, I'm 53 now, so maybe I was 37, let's call it, 38 at that point. And I had two of my own kids. I later ended up adopting a bunch of kids, so I had an even bigger family after that. And it was not a glamorous time. You know, you see a lot of stories in movies, you know, where it's very sexy to be a startup and, you know, it's a lot of young people talking fast and having parties and all this exciting thing.
Totally not true.
That was not my experience. I mean, it was a depressing, grueling, stressful period. I had kids who were in school. I had a wife who didn't work at an outside job. And I was coming close to losing my house and losing any support system and anticipating, gosh, will I have to move in with my father-in-law in Hollywood, Florida? Or if I sold my house, how much could I get? And could we afford an apartment and keep the kids in school and all that? It was not sexy or romantic or glamorous. It was depressing, stressful, and anxiety-ridden, and really would never wish it on my worst enemy. But at the same time, as I look back at it now, it was important. If it had been easy, I probably would have blown it. In other words, if I had been a wealthy man back then, I would have given it up in a heartbeat. Way too difficult. Or if I had known banking better, and I knew nothing about the financial services industry, if I had known, I would have probably dropped it because I would have known how hard it was. But I think ignorance is bliss many times when you're running a startup, and desperation is the fuel that drives ambition. And I was both desperate and didn't know everything, and I think that's came together to make a success. But as I said, it's not obvious, and it was not a pleasant or enjoyable time. It was a stressful and anxiety-ridden time for me, anyhow.
All right, desperation and ignorance. I just wrote that down as the two pillars of success. No, it's. I mean, there is a theory around, like, being too naive to know better. Right. And I think that's kind of where a lot of innovation comes from, because you don't know the rules. I think once a lot of people learn the rules, they'll they start to play by them. But
there's a great quote from the movie Titanic, which sounds silly that I'm quoting, but there's a narrative voiceover at some point in the movie, and it was talking about the captain of the Titanic, who was the most experienced captain in the White Star Fleet, I think it was called, that owned the Titanic, and they appointed this captain the head of the Titanic because he was their most experienced captain, and this was their most expensive and most important ship. And there's a great expression that says, all 35 years of that captain's experience conspired to cause the sinking of the Titanic, because the captain was so convinced that he knew the right answers. He had sailed so many other kinds of ships, but was not familiar with this new ship, with all this new technology. And that day, it was a very advanced ship for its time. And had they have had a younger, less experienced captain, he would have actually likely not sunk it. And it's a great expression, and I think that's very true in entrepreneurism, that if I had been a 35-year veteran banker, I would have had 100 reasons why this would never work, and I would never have even pursued the idea. And that's true. That's a great example.
Yeah, no, that's great. I liken myself to Denzel Washington in Flight, where I was just too inebriated to make a logical decision. That's how Innovation Crush started. So, I think the application of those rules, is there a difference between the climate of business and entrepreneurship now and the climate of business and entrepreneurship when you started it, right? Because startup is like automatic word that just falls out of people's mouths now. You join any conversation in any creative space, like, oh, I have a startup, or this is, we're looking at startups. It's startup, versus, you launched this company in a time where it wasn't as rampant or cool to be doing this. So can you kind of speak to the difference between then and now and, like, what some of the...
Well, I think there's probably more infrastructure now for somebody who has a startup. Although you had it then. You had incubators certainly then. You had a lot of venture capital and a lot of successful startups, and you had the internet bubble in 98, 99. So I think you had... certainly a lot of startups, but my sense is there's more infrastructure, there's more knowledge and more process that's put around how you build a company from scratch. But and there may be, at least in financial services, way more regulation and way more process. But having said that, I'm sure that it's very similar and probably has been. There are some great shows, if you ever get a chance to watch them, on the History Channel and others, that talk about, like, the Titans of America and how U.S. Steel was born and how General Electric was born, and really fascinating things. And even looking at those stories of entrepreneurism dating back 100 or even 200 years ago, or even America itself, which was an entrepreneurial startup by the people like George Washington and others who came over from Great Britain, right? So even the country was an entrepreneurial startup that wasn't sure that it would work and that it would make it, and broke all the rules and very unique start to our own country.
There were a lot of rules that were broken at that point in time. But yeah,
right.
But you're absolutely right. I mean, it's kind of like, and that's why, I look at sort of the Airbnbs of today, or the Ubers, and even kind of what you're doing, right, is kind of like bending the rules. I'd like to chat a little bit, obviously about GoBank and Green Dot. And I would start with, what have you learned about your demographic, right? You talk about this shift and this pivot at the very beginning where you're like, oh, that's not our audience. This is our audience.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about that group and how you've been able to grow that over the course of the years.
Well, our mission has broadened over the years, and our mission as a company, meaning Green Dot Corp and Green Dot Bank, is to reinvent personal banking for the masses. And we define the masses as, in effect, being the other 99%. Demographically, it's American households making less than $75,000 a year. And, that means that if it's a household, right, that means you could have two or three workers in that household. And so that means you're not making a lot of money in any one individual. And that demographic is more than two-thirds of the entire country. Households making less than $50,000 a year among all workers in the household is half the country. So it's a very, very big demographic. And the way that things have evolved, you have two macroeconomic changes happening that have made things look good for Green Dot and has helped us a little bit. One is the fact that the banking infrastructure that we have today in our country was never made to service low-income people at scale. So you always had low-income populations in the United States and in every country. We've always had poverty, always. But it was more of a niche kind of a thing, and people always knew where, quote-unquote, the low-income neighborhood was. They always knew what a low-income family looked like, or at least that was the way the world worked 30, 40, 50 years ago here in the United States.
Right.
Okay? But and so banking targeted middle-class Americans, upper-middle-class, and upper-class, because those were the wage earners who could afford a mortgage or a new car or could afford to pay back a credit card or whatever the case may be. And it was a very large market. When I was, again, I'm 53, when I was growing up in the 1960s America, it was very common in middle class America that you would have a neighbor who sold insurance for State Farm, another neighbor who made their living selling appliances at Sears and Roebuck. And you could make a living that way and have a very suitable middle class lifestyle in America. But you don't have that today. You have a service industry of people who are lower wage earning, and then you have wealthy folks, and the middle is really somewhat of a vast decay, if you will, of population. And so that's been a real change in our macroeconomic conditions in the country. Well, what does that mean? That means you have banks that have a model that embraced middle and upper class Americans, but there's fewer and fewer middle class. You have a lot lower middle class and lower class and a lot upper class, but that middle has vanished a little bit.
Right.
So you have a lot of Americans who are underserved by traditional banks. They can't qualify for credit. They may not be able to pay back loans and get approved by underwriting. Or there may be other conditions where they just don't have enough money in that bank account to make them a profitable customer for that bank. So we benefited from having a large population. Again, this is half the country in low income, you know, who make $50,000 or less in a household. So you have this large population that really has no bank to call their own. And I want to be that bank, and I want Green Dot Bank to be that bank. Everyone in a country like this should have a bank to call their own where they're welcome, where the bank understands how they live, where the bank understands how to underwrite them, where the bank understands what they need in their family. Every you know, citizen should have that. And I want Green Dot Bank to be that bank for this population segment. And now, so that's what that mission means for the masses.
Now, when you say bank, right, you know, a lot of different things come to mind. Like, you know, one stat that I heard is that you guys have more ATMs than Bank of America and Chase combined. Is that
right.
Correct? But no brick and mortar facility, correct?
Yeah, I mean, we don't own the ATMs, but there's a good example of innovation. Rather than go out and buying installations of ATM machines and servicing them, there are wonderful new age companies out there whose job it is to own fleets of ATMs. So we put together, cobbled together a network using partners at the companies that are in the ATM business, and cobbled together this massive network of 42,000 plus free ATM machines. And you're right, the B of A or Chase would have, say, 16,000 or 17,000 machines. So it's a very, very large network of free ATMs. But even that was an innovation, right? Because banks don't generally partner with other ATM companies. They do their own thing. And that's a good example of how we've been able to achieve a lot for our customers without spending a lot.
Well, that's funny. I mean, it's one of the, you know, when I look at sort of the poster child for big business failure is Blockbuster, right? And how Reed right. Hastings walks in this product to them and goes, hey, you want to buy this? And they're like, man, no thanks. You know, kind of kick them out the door. But, you know, one of my personal philosophies is to survive, either you mimic, collaborate, or acquire. You know, what other smaller and nimble companies are doing. And I think collaboration is key to innovation. Yeah. You guys, it sounds like you've mastered that
Yeah, we partner with a lot of innovative companies. We like innovation. And for the customer, they don't particularly care. They just want what they want when they want it. And that brings me to the second macro trend that's happening. I mentioned the first is the vanishing middle class and a lot of underserved Americans. The second macro thing benefiting us, macro trend, is millennials. So somebody asked me recently, Chris, well, how do you define a millennial? And there's years of birth and different things you can use to define that group demographically. But if you were to ask me about their characteristics, their behavior as consumers, is that these are transactional people. A millennial is a transactional person, not a relationship person. So an example is somebody older who's not a millennial may say, hey, I'm going to go buy a dress for this cocktail party. I'm going to go to Macy's. And you say, well, why Macy's? Well, that's where I always go, and I've shopped there for years, and they always have a good selection of what I want. And that's okay. Nothing's wrong with that. A younger person, a millennial, would say, hey, I want to buy a cocktail dress. They're going to go to Google, type in the phrase cocktail dress, and they're going to see a bunch of dresses pop up online, and they're going to buy one or two or three and have them delivered to their home and try it on. And they really don't care where that dress came from. Or another example, a more male example, is when I was young, if you wanted to buy a TV, you went to Sears. I'm not even sure you went anywhere else but Sears. Or a washing machine. Where else would you go but Sears? Now you type in the word washing machine and you buy it, and whether that washing machine's from Home Depot or Lowe's or Sears or B&H Camera or some appliance store in upstate New York you've never heard of, you don't care. as long as it's the brand you want at the price you want, it's going to show up at your doorstep. And so millennials have been trained to be transactional buyers. They want what they want when they want it with as little friction as humanly possible. They're not interested in the salesperson's name. They don't want to know where you went to high school. They don't want to know that you have a nice cafeteria where you can sit and have a cup of coffee while you wait for the salesman. They're transactional. And that, I think, is the biggest difference between millennials and older Americans, is that feeling of I want what I want when I want it. And they've been trained that way in the internet generation, where somebody my age was trained in a relationship-based world.
No, it's really interesting.
And that benefits us because we're a transactional bank. Our products are everywhere you are. We're easy to acquire.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. And just in that, that's a huge consumer shift, right? And I think in that, and maybe you can speak to this a little bit, how does a brand go about developing an affinity from an audience, right? Like, why would I choose the guest cocktail dress, you know, versus the other 20 that I'm served? Or if it's all about the transaction, like a GoBank versus a, you know, a Chase, you know, you're going to make it easier, but you're going to, both Chase and you want to be the preferred outlet, right? So how do you go about building affinity in an environment where it's more about the ease, I guess, if I can summarize.
Ah, that's a very sharp question. I'm trying to think how much of this I want to divulge.
Is this your secret sauce?
Well, I don't know if it's a secret sauce, but it's an ingredient in the sauce, maybe. So I mentioned that millennials are transactional. Low-income people have always been transactional in many ways. But everybody identifies with a lifestyle. So then what you have to do is develop a preference or a relationship about your transaction, which sounds counterintuitive. What I'm saying is my customer base is transactional, but they're loyal to my brand. And so you want to be the brand that is preferred for the transactional behavior, which is different than relationship banking. So I'll give you an example. You're loyal to Google as a search engine. Bing has had a difficult time catching on, and most people will still habitually go to Google as their first search option.
I don't even know what Bing is.
What's that?
No, I'm just guessing. I don't even know what Bing is. That's how far removed
that's
I am.
That's the Microsoft version
of
Google.
I'm kidding.
And it's a good service and so forth. But the point is habits are there. And the reason is that when you go to Google, you're not going there for Google. You're going there because you've been repeatedly taught that you're going to have success and that there's low friction. So whether you're buying a TV, a dress, looking for a restaurant to eat at, you're going to go to Google or you're going to go somewhere else. And so it is transactional based, but you're loyal to the service that provides that transaction. So the way that Green Dot markets itself and the way we try to make sure that we have customer preference is we make it easy to buy the card or our other services, which is that transactional part. We don't give people a hard time with fees that irritate them or collection practices that irritate them. So we're sort of low maintenance that way, if you will. But the brand means when you need something, we're here to give it to you. And Green Dot is a brand that you know, that you trust, that won't rip you off, that has been around for a long time. And so you have a very high preference for the brand, even though what we're selling is a somewhat transactional service. In the case of GoBank, which is our checking account, that is different. That is more of a longer relationship. People get it because it's easy to get, but you use it as your checking account because they like the product and they feel like they may have a relationship with the product. But it is a tough marketing challenge, and the risk of transactional companies in a millennial world is that you're hot today and maybe ice cold tomorrow. So the trick is to be able to form that relationship and be known as a good, safe transactional provider. And it is tricky. It's something we've done extraordinarily well, in part just by staying power, in part by luck, and in part by skill. But that is something we've been able to achieve with our brand, which has been very powerful for us.
Now, you know, it's interesting you talk about millennials versus low-income consumers. I would imagine in a lot of ways they're similar. Can you just talk about, like, what some of the similarities and differences are? Because I feel like if I'm, you know, 29, whatever, like when I was 29, I didn't have a lot of money anyway. So I was both. I was a millennial and I was broke. How do you separate those out, or what do you see as like some differences and similarities between the two?
No, we don't. We don't break them out. I mean, different products target different segments for different reasons. But generally, being low friction and easy to get, and having very fair and transparent fee policies, that's in fashion no matter how much you make and what your age is. So those are sort of universally held positive attributes as a brand. No, I think we try to design all of our products to be that way. But it's just that if you're older, you're likely not going to gravitate it. If you're 55 and you have money, your relationship guy is just based on how you were raised in America. So you may, if I say to you, what bank do you use? That individual may respond, oh, I use Chase. What are you using for? Everything. They're my bank. I'm a relationship guy, and I've used Chase. I'll be proud of it. For 20 years, I've been with Chase. You've heard that before, right?
Yep.
I've been with Bank of America 27 years, and they're proud of that. A millennial would never even think that way. They'd say, well, I use this for this kind of a product. I use that for that. I think I use Bill Me Later, but I'm not sure. But I think I use Bill Me Later for a loan to buy that lawnmower. And I think I used B of A once when I had a car loan, but I'm not really sure. So the mind just works differently.
Yeah.
And most of our customers, again, are in that transactional world. And so our marketing is about the reliability of the brand and that we're here when we need you. But you wouldn't have a commercial that would say Green Dot for all your banking needs. That statement would not make sense to a millennial, but it would make sense to somebody 55 or 60.
Well, it's interesting you talk about it like the transactional platforms, right? Someone sent an email around and said, oh, I have Jay-Z and Beyonce tickets. Who wants them? And I was like, I'll take them. And I was like, all right, where do you want to meet? And they were like, well, just pay me on Venmo. And I'm like, who is this really? You know, because there's this, you know, kind of, now I've been invited to another platform where I'm going to put my personal information into, and, you know, I'm making a transaction with somebody who I really don't know that well. But
right.
For whatever reason, you like, I don't know if it's peer pressure or what, if there's a psychological, you know,
kind of
term that you go like, oh, I got it. Okay, I guess I'll be cool if I use Venmo. Is there any insight you have on that sort of behavior, and especially across multiple platforms?
It is peer pressure. I think that's a very good way of describing it. It's called just like me disease. That's what I call it. The reason why the internet is so perfect for fraud for so many people is that you're on a site, whatever that site may be, Craigslist, or, you know, that's a more notorious one. And it feels like a community. And you say, well, this person is on this site just like I am. They must be like me. And you assign your attributes to them, which lowers your guard. And that's why, you know, if a stranger came up to you on the street, even if they were well-dressed and looked well-groomed and everything, and asked you for your social security number and your debit card and your personal PIN number, in a million years, you'd never do that.
Right.
Because you're looking at that person and you're saying, well, he's not like me, and why would he ask me that? And he just came up to me out of nowhere. I'm not going to trust this guy. But if that same individual sent you a message on, I don't know what, on Instagram or on Facebook and said, hey, Chris, it's Steve. Hey, I've got this really cool, you know, as you said, I got two tickets to Beyonce tonight. And if you want, I notice you're on Facebook like I am. I'll go ahead and send that to you if you give me your information. You know, you're going to do it. It's just not everybody. Some people are smarter than that. But you fall like, oh, they're honest. Well, why do you know they're honest? Well, they're on Yelp. I mean, they got a 4-star review. How bad could they be? You know, so I think that it is interesting that you would trust a perfect stranger more than you would trust somebody that you're looking at with your own eyes. But it's how the mind works. But it's called just like me disease. When you think somebody's just like you, you're more likely to trust them. And con artists know that, which is why they tend to gravitate towards those kinds of sites and why consumers need to be so aware of it.
Well, it's kind of like, I mean, you know, the old hustle used to be call old people, right? And you call and ask and tell them they won a contest or something.
Right.
Like, all I need is this information. But you're right. We've gotten to this habit of giving up our information. Now, do you see resistance? Because sometimes I have conversations around this idea of a dial back, where people are willing to give up less information unless they are a little bit more secure. We were talking earlier today about how many millions of hours worth of privacy policies are not read. Right. So you go, right. You sign up on all these platforms. You like, you scroll down and you click the box. You don't read like, oh, we now own whatever information. Like if you look at anybody's email address on Facebook, it's like stevestreet@facebook.com. You're like, that is not Steve's email address. Right. So where do you see like that willingness to give up the information versus I'm going to hold off and wait and see if I actually trust.
Well, this. I think people are getting wiser. There's been so many data breaches. And the topic of identity theft is now so widespread that I think you're seeing fewer and fewer people fall for what are called phishing scams, or the PH. You know phishing.
Yes.
Phishing scams. But still, people fall for it. The older you are, the more likely you are to fall for it because maybe the less exposed you are to modern technology and the internet. So I do think that younger people are more on guard and more wary of it than they used to be. But, yeah, people are willing to share all kinds of stuff. And of course, so with data breaches, you don't know who you're talking to many times. So there's no question that the internet and cell phones and texting and all that has broken down a barrier to common sense, which is in the old days, you looked at somebody in the eye and you made a judgment call as to whether or not you trusted them. And also, the body, I believe this, I don't know if this is a scientific fact, so I don't want to misrepresent it, but it's my belief that your body is built with lots of sensory skills.
Yes.
Have you ever gotten on an elevator with somebody and you feel just nervous, like, I don't know, this guy freaks me out, or my wife has a good sense of that. She'll say, well, I just didn't want to go in there alone because he was the only guy in there. I just felt uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah. I grew up in Detroit, so there's a lot of people I avoid.
So, but your body, and that's really nature put that in your brain to say, hey, based on the way they look, talk, are holding themselves, do they look aggressive, do they look dishonest, do they look like they're going to hurt you, your brain is processing a million facts based on your six senses that God gave you, and that's what you're living off of, and that's how we all have lived for years. The internet takes away from that, right? So when somebody says, hey, what's your social security number, we want to, your account has been closed unless you provide us with all this information. And people provide it. You say, well, why would he do that? Why did he trust him? Well, it looked official. They had the bank's logo, but they're not face-to-face, so they're not picking up all that sensory perception. And so I do find that people do really goofy things online and that information that in your right mind you'd never do in person, but that's the way it works. And I think, to your point, people are less and less doing that. I think there's been great publicity. The government's done a great job of all kinds of information around identity theft. I think banks, yeah, ours included, have done a very good job warning people that, hey, if it's too good to be true, it probably is. Never give your details to anybody online. They're strangers. Don't do it. But to your point, it does happen, and it is one of the negative side effects, I guess, of a less personal world.
Well, I think when you talk about the psychology of it all and sort of those, biosensory cues that you can pick up, I feel like the company who figures how to replicate that in a virtual environment will be a success, right? Like if I did go onto a website and there were, certain sensory cues that I could pick up on, whether that's through some sort of biometric functionality, what you'll see on an Apple Watch.
Right.
But just kind of, because, Malcolm Gladwell talks about this idea of thin slicing, where it's like the more experiences you have, the less information you need to size up the next time you encounter similar situations. I think if there's a way to replicate that in sort of a digital environment, that would be awesome.
Well, I think it's called Yelp. Pretty much you'll eat sushi at any restaurant if it has a good Yelp review, so that's how it works.
One of my favorite Instagram photos was a restaurant that said, come on in and try the worst sandwich a guy on Yelp ever had in his life. So I wanted to back up a little bit because, I mean, you've obviously become super skilled at this and very successful. But at the same time, in the beginning, you had this, sort of a misstep, right? And probably, I would imagine, the learning curve between your realization that it's not college kids, it's low-income families. was a greater learning curve to get to where you are now than it was to go from radio to prepaid calling cards. So what, how did you manage to like learn so much along the way and educate yourself to the degree that you have? I know when we talked before, you mentioned a little bit about like just natural consumer feedback that you were getting, but to be able to apply that and to continue to grow and grow and grow over the past couple of decades.
Well, I've always been gifted with the ability to learn quickly. I make a lot of mistakes. I just don't try to make them twice, but I make a lot of mistakes. And so I think I've always been fortunate to learn quickly and to read a lot and to listen a lot. And I've never been ashamed to ask for help when I need it. And I've found repeatedly, even now, that people love to help you if you ask genuinely and sincerely and politely. Nobody's going to have all the information. Nobody. I don't care who you are. Nobody's going to have all the facts. But it's amazing to me how many people won't ask. And I will. It may be somebody pouring concrete on a driveway, and I'll be curious. And I'll ask them, what does that do, and how does that work, and how come this, and isn't it going to be too dry? And they'll tell me, no, here's the deal with concrete. And before you know something's not concrete. And I do that all the time. I've always enjoyed learning, and I've always enjoyed asking intelligent and people, you know, people far smarter than me, which is not a high hurdle, I can assure you. But asking people smarter than me, how come this, and why did you say that, and how come in the meeting you looked this way when that guy said this? And people are very happy to share that information with you. And if you can store that information and order it in your brain in context, then you rapidly become knowledgeable about a subject. And I do that every day, literally every day. There's something about our business, our customers, a piece of data I'll see, a new regulation, something that I'm on the phone with somebody far more experienced and smarter than I am, asking them to help me figure that out, and they're always willing. And that's really been, I don't know if it's a secret, but that's been a big part of my success is being able to ask the right people the right questions and understanding the answers and putting them into context.
Well, it's like you have to be willing to accept, I call those mentor moments, right? You have to be willing to, you know, a lot of people go like, oh, who's your mentor? And like, I've never personally had one person that I've gone to, but I find myself because like, similarly to you, I'm just very curious. So I will ask questions and any moment can become a mentor moment, you know, if you ask enough questions and the right questions and at the right time. So that's really interesting. And I kind of, if you expand that concept, right, there is an I in street in your last name, but there is no I in team. So as you've grown, you know, you talked about, you know, your first business partner who came on and did a lot of the legwork, but now you've grown to be this corporation. How have you gone about developing your team? Like, what do you think about in terms of attributes and needs and just like, do you hire people that you can ask more questions to, or like, what's sort of the strategy and thinking that goes into your growth?
Well, sometimes, we have experts in the company who know various parts of their business very, very well. We hire experts, meaning today I was on the phone with an attorney who I asked for help because he's much smarter than a certain kind of banking product that we're trying to develop, and I don't know as much about it. So that's all this guy does. So I said, hey, can we talk for an hour and a half? I mean, obviously in that case, you're paying him, which is fine. That's all good. And could you talk to me for an hour and a half and let me share with you my ideas and tell me why it won't work or why it will work or what are the options? So sometimes you learn through very specific activities like that where you're paying somebody to help you. Other times you're observing behavior or you're reading the success or the failures of other companies. I love reading about failures. And I also love reading market reports that are negative about my company. We're a public company. We have 21 analysts. Anytime you do that, it's kind of like a bell curve where some analysts are going to think you're a great story. Some are going to think you're a horrible story. Some are going to be in the middle. And I actually read the negative analysts more than I read the positive analysts because you learn interesting things. And so you'll say, well, wow, I never thought of the company in that way, but this guy seems convinced that we have a problem here. Do we? Maybe we do. Why would he say that? He must be a smart guy. He's an analyst at a big bank. He must have a view. And I've noticed a lot of people will dismiss that. They'll say, oh, those are critics and I don't listen to them. I'm actually the reverse. When we have a critic, I mean, unless they're just idiots or whatever, but generally they're thoughtful people who have a different perspective. And he said, why would an intelligent person who clearly knows their stuff, why would they believe X when I believe Y? And it doesn't mean you'll change your mind. It doesn't mean they'll do things differently necessarily, but you learn a lot from finding people who share a different point of view. And so I do that a lot, and not everybody does it, but I think all that has been helpful into making sure that we can evolve our company, attract the right kinds of employees, empower the right kinds of employees and the right kinds of thinking. We don't do it right all the time. We make a lot of mistakes. We do a lot of stupid things. But the difference is we don't try to mask it and sweep it under the rug. You know, we will say to ourselves, hey, that was really dumb. Let's do our best not to do that twice.
Right.
And that's okay. That's how you learn. And there's nothing wrong with making mistakes. It's how you recover, I think, that ultimately dictates your future.
I think that's it's interesting that you take in the negative comments. I think because of the internet generation or the information age or however you want to call it, we do have a tendency to like ignore the negative. Like, you know, if you're a YouTube star and you got like a 98 thumbs up on your cover of Janet Jackson. I don't know where my metaphors are coming from today, but then you got those two. It's like some people get caught up on those two thumbs down comments and like it can destroy somebody. You know, we interviewed Sugar Ray Leonard a while back. And, you know, he was talking about, especially for athletes, right? Or even in fight, like personal banking is probably the most personal you can get with somebody as a business. And, you know, those comments can make or break you, I would imagine, in some instances, but you've learned to kind of turn them into positives.
I mean, I'm not saying it doesn't make you feel bad. But all I'm saying is that if you can open your mind to it and say, well, look, they're not critiquing you, Steve. They don't know you. And this is really about the stock, Green Dot the stock. Is it fair that an investor could feel this way? Is it fair that an analyst could have this concern or this fear? And oftentimes it is fair. You say, okay, well, that makes sense. I can see where they feel that way. I don't agree with them. Or, wow, that's a good point. I never thought of that. Let's make sure that we take precautions to make sure that this guy's fear doesn't become a reality. But I think you have to learn a lot from all your stakeholders. And I think as a company, we do a really good job of partnering with all kinds of stakeholders and listening to everybody's points of view. I think ultimately, while you can't please everybody all the time, that's not possible. I do think that more often than not, we end up with solutions, products, ideas that are viewed as positive by most stakeholders.
What did little Steve Street want to be when he grew up?
Well, my gosh, I wanted to be a big time radio star, and it probably was well into my 20s before I realized I wasn't talented enough to be Howard Stern, and I was barely talented enough to tune in the radio station where he was on. And when I was a kid, he was like the big act in Washington, D.C. and other places. I guess he still is pretty big. I don't know, but he was super big back then. So I wanted to be a radio superstar. Or I wanted to be a big business guy or better yet, a big business guy in radio. And so I guess I kind of fulfilled my dreams. I made it to some success in radio, but not in front of the camera, if you will, but behind the scenes. And I've done okay in business, but there are many people who've done a lot better and many people who've done a lot worse. So, you know, I've done okay.
That's great. So do you know this show is called Innovation Crush? I hope so. We've been talking for a while. By the way, we've been talking for, 47 minutes? You talked to that lawyer guy for an hour and a half. so expect a bill in the mail, at least for half. We always talk about, like, things that we're crushing on that are out in the marketplace or out in the world. Is there anything that you see out there you go, like, my gosh, that is an awesome thing? Cultural trend, restaurant, like whatever it is, if whatever comes top of mind.
You know what macro trend I like that I see in my own kids? I have a lot of kids. I have 7 kids. And I see it in the younger generation is a complete lack of judgment and a complete acceptance for all things the same and different. That was not the way my America was growing up. There are a lot of things about the old America that I miss with nostalgia of the way I miss my parents who are deceased. And I think back to the America I grew up in as a little boy, and I miss it so bad sometimes that I feel pain and mourning over it. But at the same time, I look at today's America, and I see so many exciting things that are so much better than when I was a kid. And one of those would be the complete lack of judgment and the complete acceptance of people different than you. When I was a boy, and I don't need to go into it on the broadcast, but you can guess if I grew up in the South in the 1960s. If you were not a certain way in high school or junior high school, either you're beat up,
right,
or something else. And everybody, you know, it was just a very judgmental time, and it's wonderful. I see my kids in high school and in college, and you see a student body, which it can be gay, straight, fat, thin, tall, small, black, white, and nobody would even think of making fun of them. Nobody would even think of judging this person because they're different. And that's something recent, I think, in the last 15 years or so. I just don't think that was around 25 years ago. And I love that about our country. I think President Obama has done more, whether or not you like him as a president, whether or not you agree with his policies as a leader. He's still the president of our country, and that office deserves the utmost respect and admiration. And I think that him becoming president speaks volumes about the new America. And the fact that he's done what he's done in office, whether, again, you like it or not, it's not a political statement. But the fact is that anybody can be a leader. You can now grow up in this country and be black or white or gay or straight or male or female and believe that you, too, one day can be a leader, have a great job, have significance. That is not something that would have been true of America 30 years ago. And I love that macro trend in America today. It's how I was raised. I was fortunate to be raised by very liberal parents who loved people for who they were as individuals. And I learned that from them. And I was very blessed to grow up in a household like that because that was a rare find in the South when I grew up. And at the same time, I see today's youngsters being that way. I think my mom, if she were alive, would have been very proud of what young people are like today. So that's probably my favorite macro change that I've witnessed in our country.
No, that's fascinating. You know, as you were telling us that, I kept thinking about like the influence of technology and how it's brought us closer and kind of exposed our differences, but also allowed us to celebrate them. And that comes from not only just like the categories that you mentioned, but, you know, I used to always think about like how if you and I were Facebook friends and, you know, I've known you as the bank guy. And then all of a sudden you have, you know, you go to dance class on Saturdays. I'm like, oh, dancing is cool then, right? Like it became okay to be a multi-hyphenate and you got interested in the, you know, in the things between the hyphens. And those were okay. And so you kind of like, there was just a collapse of the walls and the barriers between each other. And then in that you still found niche groups of very more specific interests, you know, even more so than, oh, I like baseball too. Right. It's like, no, I like apple pie with pecans in it. You're like, oh, me too. And like, let's start a Facebook group.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's a great evolution of our society, maybe globally, but certainly here in our country. I think people's acceptance of one another, judging people on their talent or their character or their personality. And I think that's all fair game to judge people based on their individual character, talent, and personality when you meet somebody. But we've learned, I think, as a country, at least for most evolved Americans, to not judge people based on race and sex and age. And that really is a wonderful development in our country. And I'm very proud of us for it. And I think that that's probably ultimately what will be our salvation as a country, that despite all the problems we have with employment rates and salaries and incomes and many of the macro things we were talking about earlier in this interview, that when you can work together, when that next genius who can solve the world's problems can take any form, then you start capitalizing on people's spirits and people's talent and people's character and people's ethics and ideas. And that's what ultimately will drive solutions to our biggest problems in the country. And I think that's going to turn out to be our salvation.
Yeah, that's great. You know, you when you were talking earlier about curiosity and how that breeds innovation, you know, I think the other piece of that is diverse perspectives and being able to speak to people and collaborate with people from very, very vastly different experiences than your own, and kind of like, oh, this middle ground thing that we just made up is the solution. It's, you know, but I applaud you for that perspective. As we close, I'd like for you to finish a phrase for me, if you don't mind. Okay. Innovation to me is?
thinking up good ideas that nobody else was daring enough to think of, let alone execute.
Which you have done well.
It's worked out for me, but there's others where it's worked out far better. But I think, you know, hopefully I'll live to be way older than I am today. But I think it's fair to say that in my epitaph, somebody will say I had a good idea now and again.
And maybe there'll be a little picture of a Pop-Tart right next to it.
No, I don't want to gain any weight, but they are pretty good for a once in a while treat.
I would love to die from a Pop-Tart overdose. That is a way to go. So how can people find you in the social sphere, or find Green Dot? Let's do the shameless plugs and find out where we can stalk you a little bit.
Well, Green Dot's website is greendot.com, ironically enough. So it's greendot.com. And because I'm the CEO of a publicly traded company, I'm not allowed to have Facebook. I have one, but it's private. It's blocked. And I can't have any kind of social media because, unfortunately, that's one of the negative sides about being a CEO. But our company does. You have gobank.com. You have greendot.com. You can send notes in through there. And you can send me an email. And I'll give you my email address. How's that? But just don't ask for a reply because if I get too many, I may not be able to reply. But you want the email address?
Just don't expect me to say anything back to you. It's up to you. This is your stage today.
Sure. Let's do it. You feel free to email me. Just again, don't ask for a quick reply, depending on the day. So it's sstreet, S-S-T-R-E-I-T, at greendot.com. And if you want to email me with thoughts or whatever, I read them all. It just sometimes takes me a while. And I'd love to hear from anybody who wants to communicate.
That's awesome, and very generous. So thank you so much for joining us. This has been great. We haven't had a chance to have a talk around finance, and you were the perfect guy for it. So I appreciate that.
Well, I enjoyed it, and good questions, and enjoy your podcast, and have a great day. Thank you for inviting me.
All right. Everyone, that was Steve Street from Green Dot. And this has been another installment of Innovation Crush. We'll talk to you next time.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schleichinger, I've been friends with her for 10 years. One of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore because it's here and it's funny. And I love you.